This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Mind Hacking, How to Change Your Mind for Good in 21 Days by Sir John Hargrave, read by the author.
Prologue. My Story. The day I gave up drinking was the day the Secret Service stormed my living room. Stormed might be too strong a word, since they asked if they could come in first. They were polite about it, two senior agents and a younger guy in his 20s. Maybe I should have said no, but I was still a little buzzed from lunch. It was the Friday before Labor Day, and I had polished off a couple of beers with some coworkers before leaving work early and coming home. I only drank on special occasions, such as weekdays. At the time, I was running a humor website that was known for doing outrageous stunts to get publicity and promotion. One of my favorite pranks was getting a credit card in a celebrity's name. It was surprisingly easy to do. You just called up your credit card company, told them you wanted to add an additional cardholder, and gave them a famous person's name. Like, say, Barack Obama. At the time I got the fake credit card with Barack Obama's name, he had not been officially nominated as a candidate for the 2008 presidential election, but I could see it was likely he'd end up in the Oval Office. So I gleefully wrote up the story of my credit card prank, which brought in loads of traffic to our website. I had been taking bigger and bigger risks with my pranks, trying to outdo myself, and I thought pranking the president was pretty much the pinnacle. I was right. The day after Obama received the official nomination, the Secret Service were on my doorstep. As they filed in, I led them to the living room where two of the agents sat on the sofa. I sat on the love seat. The senior agent stood in front of my fireplace, facing me, his arms folded. None of the movie cliches applied. They were not wearing earpieces or sunglasses. Also, they were in my living room, which I've never seen in a movie. You may not realize that the Secret Service not only protects presidential candidates, explained the agent sitting on my couch, but we also protect the nation's money supply. So by getting a credit card in Obama's name, you've put yourself in the crosshairs of what we do. He was in his mid to late 40s with a receding hairline and dark, penetrating eyes. Identity theft carries a maximum of 15 years in federal prison, added the stocky agent in front of the fireplace, then looked around. You've got a beautiful house here, a nice family. He paused. It would be a shame to throw all that away. I'd been in some insane situations, but my heart was pumping alcohol-fueled adrenaline to my brain. Perhaps that explained the thought running through my mind, which was, I will not give them the credit card. We'd like the credit card, said the stocky agent, his arms still folded. My voice was shaking. I can't do that. Yeah, why not? Technically, the credit card belongs to the credit card company, I replied, citing a little-known legal loophole. I can't give it to you without their permission. We'll call them, said the agent on the couch, dialing the credit card company on his cell phone. Apparently, they had anticipated this. 1 second. I said, and walked to my computer bag, shaky-legged, to get my voice recorder. If I was going to give up my precious credit card, at least I was going to record the conversation so I could write about it on my website. What's that? Demanded the stocky one. I need to tell you that I will be recording this conversation, I answered, hitting the record button. They looked at each other, and with surprising swiftness, rose to leave. This interview is over, said the stocky one as they stormed out the door and drove off. I watched them until they turned the corner, then breathed a huge sigh of relief. Then I calmly walked into the bathroom and puked. That night was one of the worst of my life. My wife was furious that I hadn't just handed over the credit card. We were both terrified, having no idea whether the Secret Service would be back later in the night to search the house or simply haul me off to jail. "If they come back," she said, "you know what they'll find." I had grown increasingly dependent on marijuana, relying on it as the source of my creativity and inspiration, even as it had led me to take wilder and wilder risks. Now I had a young family, the Secret Service was on my doorstep, and I wanted to hold on to the weed even more than the credit card. "I can't get rid of that," I said. "You don't know what you're asking." "You have to get rid of it," she insisted. "Either the drugs go, or I do." Did she say that? In my head, at least, she said that. Somehow I had the clarity to see that this was a moment of truth. If I continued with my drinking and drugs, it would ultimately be the end of my marriage, my family, and, as the Secret Service agent said, my home. Inside, I was at war with myself. I wanted so desperately to be free of my addictions, yet I did not have the courage to give up these things I loved so much. I was furious with my wife, American Express, and the U.S. government. They put me in this position of hopelessness and despair. They were responsible. I was nearly in tears when I finally snapped. "Fine," I shouted. "If I'm throwing that away, then I'm also throwing away all the liquor." It was the kind of all-or-nothing thinking that is common with alcoholics, but in this case, it saved my life. I furiously grabbed bottles from cabinets, throwing them into boxes and loading them into the car. That's how I found myself in an alley, behind my local supermarket, throwing away $1,000 worth of perfectly good liquor into a dumpster. I can't explain how difficult this was. It was the Friday night of a long holiday weekend, and while everyone else was starting the partying, all I could think was, "I will never have fun again." The thought was so painful that I had to redirect my mind with great effort from thinking about the long-term consequences of what I was doing. "I should really be giving this away to someone," my mind would think, as I tossed in champagne from my wedding, bottles of grappa bought in Italy, and French wines I had been saving for a special occasion, like Thursday. The temptation to keep a few bottles to give to a friend was overwhelming, but I kept redirecting my mind, just focusing on throwing in the next bottle and the next bottle, until all that was left was the marijuana. I got back in the car and drove around town for a while, trying to summon the courage. "Think of all the good times we've had with this drug," my mind told me. "Think of all the crazy, hilarious ideas it's given us. Think of facing life all alone, without its warm, comforting haze." I finally pulled into an empty parking lot and gazed at a trash can. Maybe if I could redirect my mind to the physical movement of throwing away the drugs, I could get through this. No long-term implications, just the muscle movement of tossing the bag into the trash. One moment at a time, I walked step by step to the trash can. My mind tried to stop me, but I kept redirecting it to the next moment, and the next. With an overwhelming pang of sadness and loss, I threw the drugs away. My precious, lost to the fires of Mount Doom. I didn't realize it at the time, but that technique of redirecting the mind was my first mind hack. It was a technique I would use over and over again in the following months as I struggled to stay sober. Over time, I developed a catalog of these mind hacks, slowly reprogramming my craving for mind-altering drugs with mind-altering mental habits. Just as it took some time to really see the transformation of my mind, it took some complicated legal wrangling before I finally gave up Barack Obama's credit card. It seems crazy now that I didn't just hand it over immediately, but it shows how we can become blind to our own insane thought patterns. The agents sitting in my living room were just a symptom of my bad thinking. The real problem ran much deeper. Now I'm just incredibly grateful for that experience because it not only changed my mind, it changed everything. I have come to have incredible respect and gratitude for the Secret Service. Never mind protecting the president, the way I see it, the Secret Service saved me. Reprogramming my mind. The first few months of sobriety were unbearable, and so was I. Every day was a roulette wheel of emotion. I could be furious, anxious, sulky, moody, or depressed, often simultaneously. One thought, however, slowly began to sprout a little bud of hope. What if there was a way to reprogram my mind? Programming is in my blood. One of my earliest memories was my father taking me to visit the computer lab at the university where he worked. In my mind, the college's mainframe computer stood illuminated by a shaft of divine light with a choir of angelic voices. In reality, it was probably fluorescent light and the whir of industrial air conditioning units. But the effect on me was no less profound. Somehow, that moment implanted a little seedling of geek into my tender 8-year-old uterus. Please don't ask me why I had a uterus. My father approached the resident computer programmer, a heavyset man with a large walrus-like mustache. "Ronald, this is John," my father introduced me.
"Hey."
Ronald looked down at me, tape reels spinning in the background. I might be mixing up some details of the story with a series of TV commercials for Controlled Data Institute.
"What can I do for you?"
"Can you create a punch card with John's name on it?" my father asked.
"Sure."
Ronald handed me a card, a little larger than an index card with small rectangular holes punched out. It was mind-blowing to stand in that computer lab among those massive, mysterious machines that required a swimming pool of coolant to keep them from overheating. I had the distinct feeling that in here was another world. I've since lost the punch card, but I'll never lose that memory. When the cost of your own computer, your very own computer, finally became affordable, I would pore over computer catalogs like earlier generations of kids would fantasize about Red Ryder BB guns. I drooled over the latest machines with sexy names like TRS-80 and TI-99-4A. The pages of my catalog stuck together with saliva and nerd sweat. I begged, cajoled, and badgered my parents until they finally bought me the legendary Commodore 64, the computer that changed my life. They didn't just buy me a computer, they let me keep it in my room. There I began programming with a vengeance. There wasn't much to do in my hometown, so I immersed myself in the secret language of computers, teaching myself the basics. Flowcharts, algorithms, variables, loops. I was lucky enough to get in the first programming class taught at my middle school, and by the end of the semester, I was teaching the teachers. Details are sketchy on when I lost my virginity, but I distinctly remember when I made my first computer hookup. I had just bought a modem for my Commodore 64, and I dialed into a friend's computer. One of the few people in my town who also had a modem, or who knew what a modem was. At first, there was nothing but a blank screen. I waited, not knowing what to expect. Slowly, the following letters appeared across my screen.
"Can you see this?"
With that, the back of my head exploded. Here was my friend across town typing into his computer and having it instantly appear in my room. It was one of those transformative moments, my own version of Samuel Morse's first telegraph message, "What hath God wrought?" At that moment, I realized there was a way out. Growing up in a small town without much to do, I suddenly understood my modem was a portal into another world. I could communicate with other people, no matter where they were, in a strange digital world which somehow existed alongside the physical world. But unlike the physical world, the digital world gave me new powers, and I had the profound realization that we could master these powers. After college, I landed a job at Ziff Davis, the world's largest computer magazine publisher, just as the digital revolution hit. I remember the first time I sent an email, the first time I saw the internet, the first time I published a web page. Each time there was a feeling of incomprehensible joy that the world is so much bigger and cooler than I imagined, a feeling that continues to grow and expand to this day. Because I grew up viewing the world through this lens of world-expanding technology, when it came time to get sober, it seemed natural to view my mind as a kind of computer. It struck me that a lot of the feelings and thoughts I was experiencing were like Adobe products, powerful but riddled with bugs. Could I reprogram my mind? Could I hack into the source code and change the way my mind worked? Was there an algorithm for recovery? I began to look for mind hacks, techniques to identify and reprogram my problem thinking. I scoured textbooks of psychology, neuroscience, and computer science. I immersed myself in the latest research. I collected techniques from the greatest minds in history, from Albert Einstein to Benjamin Franklin to Nikola Tesla. My goal was to create a formula, a collection of specific exercises, things I could do and measure that would allow me to debug my problem thinking, then write powerful new code to rocket my life into exciting new orbits. As I practiced these mental exercises day after day, I found that not only was I staying sober, but my mind was getting better. Like the world-expanding moments I had experienced with technology, my mind itself was expanding, and so was my life. Years later, I come to you with a powerful message of hope. Not only have I become healthy, wealthy, and wise, but I have become friends with my own mind. I am happily married, a successful entrepreneur surrounded by amazing friends. My life is rich in every sense of that word and growing richer by the day. I want to share with you what I found. Think of the problems you're facing in your life, whether that's work, finances, health, relationships, kids, and reflect on how much time you spend thinking about them. If you hate that sense of obsessive worry and anxious doubt, then mind hacking is for you. You'll learn how to debug the negative thought loops that are keeping you stuck to untangle your spaghetti mess of thinking. Alternately, think of your goals and dreams, whether they're finding happiness, building relationships, achieving success, growing rich, or mastering the game of life. Actual life, not the board game. Mind hacking teaches you how all these things begin in your mind and how you can reprogram your thinking to get there, to soak up the best things that life has to offer. This is not just a book about overcoming addiction. It's a book about overcoming your mental limitations. You're about to learn powerful techniques that can help you accomplish anything you can imagine, whether that's losing weight, changing habits, starting a business, finding love, or building wealth. Your mind holds incredible untapped potential. Get ready to learn how to unlock it. Welcome to Mind Hacking. What is mind hacking? Hacker. A person who enjoys learning the details of programming systems and how to stretch their capabilities, as opposed to most users who prefer to learn only the minimum necessary. The Hacker's Dictionary. One of the greatest moments in computer history occurred, as it so often does, in an ordinary office cubicle. Steve Wozniak was working late. After clocking out of his day job at Hewlett-Packard, he would often stay into the night to work on a secret side project. It was the mid-1970s, and he and his buddy Steve Jobs had recently been inspired by a demonstration of the Altair 8800, a build-it-yourself computer kit aimed at hobbyists. They had the radical idea that they could offer a similar computer already built. The user would still need to add a keyboard, video display, and a case, but the motherboard would be fully assembled and ready to crunch. That computer, which would later be known as the Apple I, was the project that Wozniak was working on whenever he could find a spare moment. To finance their invention, Wozniak had sold his beloved HP 65 calculator and Jobs his treasured Volkswagen bus. Of the two, Wozniak was the technical genius, so into the night he toiled, long after his coworkers had gone home, in pursuit of this groundbreaking computer. One night, he hooked up a keyboard and a video display to his prototype, and something amazing happened. It worked! "I typed a few keys on the keyboard, and I was shocked," he remembered. "The letters were displayed on the screen. It was the first time in history anyone had typed a character on a keyboard and seen it show up on their computer screen right in front of them. Today, we're surrounded by screens, so it is difficult to capture what must have felt like magic to Wozniak. It was like opening a portal to another dimension, discovering an entire world that we had the power to manipulate. I sometimes still have that same sense of wonder and excitement when I'm using computers, even when doing something as ordinary as typing this paragraph. How is it that I can punch a cluster of plastic keys and have these words show up on a glowing screen? How can I speak into a phone and instantly have access to the complete store of human knowledge? How can I swipe my finger and launch a ham into orbit?" For the first time in history, we humans live in two worlds, the physical world of objects and the digital world of websites, apps, and video games. We may still call the physical world the real world, but that's just a figure of speech. The digital world is no less real than the physical world, just different. Similarly, our mental world is no less real than the physical world, just different. Computers have given us an excellent model for thinking about the mind. Our thoughts are like bits. They're transient, ephemeral, invisible. And with some basic tools, they can be manipulated to do new and amazing things. An epiphany like Woz had in his cubicle all those years ago. Mind hacking is like hooking up a keyboard to your head. The early hackers. Quote, "Most of our generation scorned computers as the embodiment of centralized control. But a tiny contingent, later called hackers, embraced computers and set about transforming them into tools of liberation. That turned out to be the true royal road to the future." Unquote. Stuart Brand, writer and hacker. If you were a computer user in the 1970s, there's a good chance you were a hacker. Hackers flourished on the campuses of schools like MIT and Stanford, as well as hundreds of defense contracting companies and research laboratories around the world. They were as obsessed with learning as they were unconcerned with hygiene. Hackers were often solitary creatures typing with pizza-stained fingers at unfathomable speeds. They might have been lonely, but they weren't alone. In the early days, hackers communicated through a high-speed global network known as ARPANET, an early precursor to the Internet. This strange new medium let them exchange ideas, information, jargon, and jokes. It was a creative, collaborative community of like-minded geeks. Hacking was a badge of honor. It meant you not only loved technology, you understood how to use it to innovate and explore. You could write new programs by manipulating lines of obscure code. You could build your own motherboard. You could make a computer do something no one had imagined before. As their numbers grew, hackers became a tribe, complete with their own language, values, and humor. As the tribe grew, so did its power. ARPANET eventually became the Internet, which transformed every aspect of modern life. Education, government, finance, sex, even our view of the world. After the smoke clears, historians will agree the digital revolution made the Renaissance look like a picnic lunch. And it was all started by hackers. Today, a similar revolution is beginning, one that takes place not on keyboards and screens, but entirely in your mind. Like the digital revolution, which couldn't be seen but was profound in its impact, this revolution is a silent meteorite hurtling toward Earth, a massive shift in human thinking. Just as the early hackers overturned the world with technology, mind hackers are overturning the world of thought. Principle number one, mind hacking is free. Quote, to be a hacker, one had to accept the philosophy that writing a software program was only the beginning. Improving a program was the true test of a hacker's skills. Unquote. Sam Williams, Free as in Freedom, Richard Stallman's Crusade for Free Software. If there is one man in the world who does not get enough credit for his contribution to society, it is Richard Stallman. Stallman deserves to be up there with Charles Babbage and Alan Turing and all those other stars in the geek constellation. A complex and controversial character, Richard Stallman has influenced your life and the technologies that you use in profound ways. And the thing that set Stallman off on his history-altering crusade was a printer jam. In 1977, Stallman was a programmer at MIT's Artificial Intelligence Lab. Whenever he wanted to print a document from his workstation, he had to send the print job to the shared printer, which was located on another floor. After trudging up the stairs, Stallman would often find the printer was jammed, stuck in the middle of someone else's 50-page print job. He'd clear out the paper jam, then babysit the machine until it jammed again. This would happen over and over, and then the printer would run out of paper. The brilliant 27-year-old had recently graduated from Harvard, where he had quickly become a fixture in the hacker community. As he stood over the printer, stewing over another paper jam, he began to approach the problem like a hacker. He couldn't keep the printer from jamming, but he could motivate his coworkers to clear the jams. Rushing back to his desk, he cracked open the source code of the printer program and came up with a brilliant hack. Who would be the most motivated to clear out a paper jam? Someone waiting to print a document. So whenever the printer jammed, he instructed the central computer to send out this alert to everyone waiting for something to print. The printer is jammed. Please fix it. By sending the alert to people with waiting print jobs, he crowdsourced the solution before that was even a word. The solution was simple and elegant, and it worked. until the day the new printer arrived. The new laser printer was donated by Xerox's Park Lab, the research and development unit responsible for world-changing innovations like the graphical user interface, Ethernet, and the personal computer. But in this case, Xerox made one world-changing mistake. They refused to release the source code to the printer program. This meant Stallman couldn't reprogram it. Now, when the inevitable paper jams occurred, Stallman was back to banging his head on the printer, his blood slowly boiling as each excruciatingly slow but laser-crisp page was excreted from the printer. Most of us can relate to the scene in Office Space where the three geeks take a printer out into a field for a gangland-style execution. Small technology annoyances can build up over time until one day your rage explodes and you find yourself in a field with a baseball bat, your hands stained with toner. So you can understand why Stallman tracked down the programmer of the printer software, who had now taken a job at Carnegie Mellon, then flew out to visit him. Stallman asked in a friendly way, hacker to hacker, if he could have a copy of the source code. The programmer refused. Something inside Stallman snapped. "I was so angry I couldn't think of a way to express it," Stallman recalled later. "So I just turned away and walked out without another word." To Stallman, it was a betrayal of the hacker ethic, a violation of the shared code that everyone should share code. This started what can only be called a holy war. Stallman became an outspoken activist that all software should be free to use, study, distribute, and modify. He began publishing manifestos, started the Free Software Foundation, and invented a new alternative to copyright called copyleft. His revolutionary idea was that software with a copyleft license could be freely modified and copied as long as the resulting software was also free. In other words, programmers could rest assured that the work they put into improving software, like hacking a solution to the printer jam problem, would forever benefit the world, not be locked up and patented by some bloated software corporation. Stallman's copyleft license and later variants of it had world-changing effects. It spawned GNU and Linux, which currently run a third of all web servers. It gave rise to Apache, which is used by over half the servers in the world. It birthed Firefox, which is used by a quarter of all people on the web. PuTTY, GIMP, Bugzilla, Thunderbird, Bitcoin, you could list literally thousands of projects, millions of developers, and billions of users benefiting from open source software. And it all started in Richard Stallman's mind. The mind hacking movement is free. It's called mind hacking, not mind hacking with a registered trademark symbol, because we all own it. The online version of this book is under a Creative Commons copyleft license, available for free. The tools and techniques you'll learn in this book are also free, which means they can be copied, modified, and improved. Like open source software, together we are inventing a science of self-improvement. Our goal is to be able to say with a high degree of confidence, if you do X, then you can expect result Y, tested and retested with hundreds of thousands of volunteers. These should not be vague and nebulous instructions like think positively, but specific things you can do. And they should work for the majority of people who put in the effort to actually do them. Stallman didn't know how to fix the printer, so he found a hack that let him work around that limitation. Mind hacking should have that same spirit of creative problem solving. It should let the majority of us hack our minds via the simple, elegant solutions dreamed up by smart people like you. Principle number two, Mind hacking is experimental, and you are the experiment. Seth Roberts, like so many of us, had acne. Before he became the emeritus professor of psychology at UC Berkeley, a respected scientist and a best-selling author, Seth Roberts had zits. His dermatologist prescribed the antibiotic pill tetracycline, a typical acne treatment at the time. Roberts was a grad student studying experimental psychology, so as practice for his class, he began experimenting on himself. He varied his daily dosage of tetracycline from 0 to 6 pills, then wrote down the number of pimples on his face each day. To his surprise, he found the dosage of his medication made absolutely no difference. One day, Roberts ran low on tetracycline pills, so he tried an over-the-counter benzoyl peroxide cream instead. To his surprise, the number of pimples decreased. When he stopped using the benzoyl peroxide cream, more pimples. When he started back up, fewer pimples. This simple self-experimentation showed him that tetracycline didn't work for his acne, and benzoyl peroxide did. He learned something that his dermatologist, the expert, didn't know. Later research studies would show that certain types of acne are antibiotic resistant, but of course, Roberts already knew that. My experience has shown that improve your life self-experimentation is remarkably powerful, wrote Roberts in Tim Ferriss's masterpiece of self-experimentation, The 4-Hour Body. I wasn't an expert in anything I studied, but I repeatedly found useful cause and effect relationships that the experts had missed. The exercises you'll read in this book can be done on yourself. In fact, the only way to prove they work for you is through experimenting on yourself. By working together, mind hackers can also pool our self-experiments. We can show through millions of personal tests what works for the majority of us, making the program even better. You benefit from all the mind hackers who have gone before you, and you in turn help the generation to come. By helping stress test the system, you reduce your own stress. Because the mind is such an intimate, personal experience, you are the only person who can determine if it works for you. The nature of the mind means that you can't take someone else's word for it. You have to discover it yourself. You're the scientist, and your mind is the experiment. Principle number 3, mind hacking is mastery. Think back to the beginning of your geekhood. Whatever your geek obsession, whether you're into computers or comics or candle making, try to capture that feeling of first discovering the thing you loved so much. You probably weren't being paid to learn it. You were just learning it because you couldn't help yourself. It was intrinsically fascinating and intellectually stimulating. But more than that, there was a feeling of what I can only call joyful power in conquering everything there was to know about that subject. If you had to put that feeling into one word, it was probably mastery. In Daniel H. Pink's Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us, he argues that mastery is one of the great motivators of human achievement. This is why we spend hours detailing our maps of Middle Earth or memorizing a complicated riff on the ukulele. No one is paying us. The satisfaction of mastery is greater than any monetary reward. The one thing that defines geeks is that we want to conquer a tiny piece of the world. We turn our death ray intellects on a small subset of the world, desiring to possess it utterly. Whether that's hand forging a battle axe for the Renaissance fair, folding the world's largest origami crane, or learning all the lyrics to The Music Man. We want to bring order to chaos, to control the uncontrollable. In a word, mastery. To master your mind is to master your life. There is no more worthwhile pursuit. As satisfying as it is to find 100% of the hidden weapons in your favorite video game, or to commit to memory lengthy poems in Klingon, if a fraction of that time can be spent mastering your mind instead, you will have a master key that can unlock all doors. Approaching your mind with that same geeky mix of curiosity and craving, that spirit of conquering and completion, is what mind hackers are after. Remember that feeling. It is your fuel. As Nerdist founder Chris Hardwick has advised in his excellent book, The Nerdist Way, see if you can take your laser-like powers of geek focus and train them on your own mind. Mind hacking is free. Mind hacking is experimental. Mind hacking is mastery. We've learned the ground rules. Now, let's learn how to hack. Hello, world. It's 2 o'clock p.m. on a cloudy November afternoon, and nearly 100 developers are furiously typing on laptops at the Microsoft complex in Cambridge, Massachusetts. A large table is covered with energy drinks, coffee, and half-eaten pasta, the evidence of a massive all-night coding session. One of the developers is blowing a straw over a circuit board trying to play Mary Had a Little Lamb on a makeshift electric harmonica. Another group is holed up in a conference room in front of a massive LED grid which pulses in time to a techno beat. This is the annual Music Hack Day, a 24-hour hackathon to build something cool related to technology and music. The goal of a hackathon is to pitch, program, and present a working app within an incredibly short window of time, say 24 hours. Teams pitch their ideas to an enthusiastic crowd, pull an all-night coding marathon to get it finished, then demo their final software product the following afternoon. Unlike the typical software development cycle that can take months, hackathons cram all that innovation and problem-solving into one caffeine-fueled blur of excitement. By 3 o'clock, it's time for the demos to start in the main conference room. There are 60 teams, so each group gets exactly 2 minutes to present. The first team shows off a stringed instrument made of yarn, which plays pre-recorded samples when you pluck the strings. Another shows an app called Hipstars, which analyzes your music tastes and gives you a 1 through 5 hipster rating. One group shows off a demo called Entrance Music that senses when you enter a room, then cues a computer to play your own customized theme song. The demos are creative, weird, and entertaining, and they were built in 24 hours. How do they do it? Talking about the right way to hack is like talking about the right way to play jazz piano, or write a novel, or raise a child. Hacking is a blend of creative and technical skills, an art, and a science. There is an overall process, however, that we can talk about in 3 broad categories. Number 1, analyzing. We look at an existing piece of technology and figure out how it works. If we're hacking a remote control, for example, we might learn all about its programming codes or circuitry. Along the way, we identify problems or bugs and think of a way around them. Number 2, imagining. Creativity is at the core of hacking, ideally with an attitude of fun and playfulness. We imagine something new, some unexpected use for the thing. Could that remote control lift a toilet seat up and down? Number 3, reprogramming. We repurpose the technology to create the thing we've imagined. We write the code, solder the circuit board, duct tape the hovercraft. Through skill, iteration, and persistence, we make the idea a reality. Behold, the remote-controlled toilet seat. In mind hacking, we take the same approach, analyzing the source code of the mind, imagining how cool it would be to make it do something else, then reprogramming the code with determined persistence until we see our lives transformed. This book, then, is organized into three parts: analyzing, imagining, and reprogramming, with do-it-yourself mind games to help you learn each set of skills. I highly encourage you to play the mind games and to keep track of your daily data in the practice sheet at the end of this book or via the app at www.mindhacky.ng. This is how you monitor your progress and prove to yourself the program is working. Like a scientist, write down your results. Not only will writing things down help you learn mind hacking, but multiple studies have shown it will help you feel better. In one experiment, people who had recently lost their job spent a few minutes each day writing their thoughts and feelings about the layoff in a personal journal. After a few weeks, not only did test subjects experience improved physical and psychological well-being, but they were rehired significantly faster than those who did not write. When we think of great explorers like Columbus, Vespucci, and Cousteau, we hold them up as courageous heroes who conquered the globe. But now the outer world has been discovered. The next phase is inward, into the mysterious and fathomless reaches of our own minds. Those of us exploring our own mental potential are the next generation of explorers. And the best part is, you can join us. But like these explorers, you have to draw a map. Magellan didn't go anywhere without a pencil. The time has come to decide. Your moment of truth. There is a tradition among geeks when learning a new programming language to start by creating a simple one-line program that displays the words, "Hello, world." Not only is this an easy first step to learning a new language, it also represents a sort of happy birth into the new environment. If you really want to learn mind hacking and not just read about it, then I challenge you now to build up your desire, overcome your inertia, and take this critical first step. Begin mind game. Accepting the quest. Turn to the practice sheet. Write today's date, followed by "Hello, world." Decide on a specific time and place you will practice mind hacking each day, and keep the book in that spot to record your daily data. You can also download the app at www.mindhacky.ng for daily reminders and community support. End mind game. You're listening to the audiobook, which also has bonus material that will walk you through each day's exercises. Each night, record the results of your daily practice. Each morning, as soon as you get up, the book will serve as a visual reminder to start your practice again. The physical book is designed to help you create this virtuous circle, a self-reinforcing loop that moves you forward. Similarly, the practice sheet is designed as a 21-day plan, an easy-to-follow framework that will cement your mind-hacking skills, transform your thinking, and change your life. It's fine to miss a day here or there, but you will get maximum benefit from mind-hacking if you complete the entire sheet. If you're serious about becoming a mind-hacker, then make that commitment to achieve 100% completion. Casual readers can still benefit from the book by picking up specific techniques that you can try out on your own thinking. For those hacking hobbyists, you can find a quick reference list of mind hacks at the end of the book. If you find them useful, then I encourage you to reread the book and complete the full 21-day program. Along the way, make it a point to teach what you're learning to other people. Share your mind hacks with others. The Roman philosopher Seneca said, "While we teach, we learn." And educators have long known the best way to lock in your own understanding of a topic is to teach it to someone else. Explaining these concepts to other people will not only help them, it will help you, because you will be able to articulate your understanding more clearly. Ultimately, mind hacking is a great experiment that you can test for yourself. In fact, the only way to verify that mind hacking works is to try it on your own mind. The testing environment is yourself, and you are the ultimate proof. Now let's get hacking! Part 1. Analyzing. 1.1. You are not your mind. Quote, "When people look at it, it looks crazy. That's a very natural thing. Sometimes when we look at it, it looks crazy. It is the result of reasoned engineering thought. But it still looks crazy." Unquote. Adam Steltzner, NASA engineer. On August 5th, 2012, the engineers at NASA endured 7 minutes of adrenaline-pumping terror. They were monitoring the descent of Curiosity, a robotic rover the size of a car, as it landed on the surface of Mars. Hanging in the balance, and in the Martian atmosphere, was years of effort, the reputation of the agency, and $2.5 billion of research money. The NASA control room was eerily silent, a high-stakes gamble on the engineering talent of everyone in the room. The lead engineer, Adam Steltzner, represented a new breed of that talent. With pierced ears, snakeskin boots, and an Elvis haircut, he looked more like a rocker than an engineer. He had overseen the complicated entry, descent, and landing sequence in which Curiosity would have to brake from 13,000 miles an hour to zero in a perfect, tightly coordinated landing, all under its own automatic guidance systems. Steltzner was also media savvy, creating a short film before Curiosity's descent in which he explained the 7 minutes of terror. "From the top of the atmosphere down to the surface," he explained, "it takes us 7 minutes. It takes 14 minutes or so for the signal from the spacecraft to make it to Earth. That's how far Mars is away from us. So when we first get word that we've touched the top of the atmosphere, the vehicle has been alive, or dead, on the surface for at least 7 minutes. During that 7 minutes, Curiosity's heat shields would burn up to 1600 degrees Fahrenheit. Its parachute would deploy, withstanding 65,000 pounds of force and slowing the descent to 200 miles per hour. Then the rover would cut the parachute and start the rockets, first diverting the rover away from the parachute, then looking for its targeted landing spot, a deep crater next to a 3.5-mile-high mountain. Because the rockets would kick up a blinding dust cloud, they were attached to a bridle or platform that would stabilize about 65 feet above the surface of Mars, then lower the rover down gently, tethered by a long robotic umbilical cord. The rockets would then cut themselves free, shoot themselves out of the way, and Curiosity would phone home. Or not. Steltzner and his team, along with geeks all over the world, held their breath. For 7 excruciating minutes, long rows of blue-shirted engineers at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory monitored the data on a 7-minute space-time delay. Suddenly, the entire room erupted in applause and celebration. Engineers leapt out of their seats, hugging each other, taking off their glasses and wiping their balding heads. They were laughing, whooping, and hollering. Curiosity had landed safely. Over the official broadcast, the mission controller was also shouting for joy. After a few moments, he regained his composure. When you watch the video, you can still hear the excitement in his voice as he speaks the words. It's time to see where Curiosity will take us. In the ensuing years, Curiosity has done extensive biological, chemical, and geological exploration of the planet. It has discovered that Mars may have once supported microbial life. It is even preparing the way for human exploration of Mars. All this controlled by its human masters from their command center back on Earth. In a weird way, you are a kind of rover. Not on Mars, but on Earth. Instead of cameras and thermometers, your sensory data comes in via eyes, ears, nose, mouth, and skin. Like Curiosity, you are able to process this data through a layer of software called your mind. Through this mind, you are able to direct specific commands, as NASA engineers are able to direct Curiosity. Raise arm. Practice banjo. Execute perfect three-point parking maneuver. Imagine for a moment that you are the one controlling Curiosity via a high-tech virtual reality control room. Your eyesight is wired to its Martian cameras. Your muscle movements control its robotic arms and sensors. Your very thought propels its motorized treads along the planet's rocky surface. In a sense, that's what's happening right now in the Earth rover that is your body. But if the mind is the software layer, then who's controlling the mind? Who's the Adam Stelzner of your mind, the one who engineered it in the first place? You are. You are not your mind. This is the message I want to shout from the rooftops. You are not your mind! Close your eyes and think about your own mind for just a moment. The fact that you can observe your mind and think about it objectively shows there is a mind and then an observer of the mind, which we'll call you. In other words, you can separate your mind, which you have just pictured, with you, the one who is doing the picturing. Got it? You've probably got it. But this idea is so fundamental to mind hacking and yet so foreign to our everyday experience that I will illustrate it via several different analogies. These analogies will serve as handy tools for peeling away you from your mind, which a mind hacker must be able to do at will. If you're a movie geek like me, perhaps you've had the experience of deconstructing a movie as you're watching it. It's the opening credits of The Lord of the Rings, and you're watching the title sequence, analyzing the music. Now comes the first scene, and you're evaluating the actors, admiring the cinematography, imagining the director, orchestrating the action. And then, if it's a good movie, you quickly get lost in it, losing your perspective. You forget to analyze the movie because you're in it. Your mind is like that movie. Just as in the movie theater there is you watching a movie, in your own head there is you watching your mind. And like a great piece of cinema, you are absorbed in the movie of your mind, the thoughts, emotions, memories served up in a constant stream. But the mind is no ordinary movie. It's a 3D IMAX Oculus Rift full-on sense-around with THX Epic beamed directly into your head. And it's been playing since birth. So it's no wonder that we're so accustomed to watching it. It's a lifetime habit. And no one's ever told us, hey, you're watching a movie. Instead, they've told us, This is reality.
I sometimes picture a virtual reality mask that you pull on with headphones and goggles, but also with